Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Trantz. We are live from the Kintech studio. Kintech, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at DunbarLumber.com. All right, so we've talked at length about the Thatcher Demko injury, Casey DeSmith getting the start in Game 2 for the Canucks as they look to take a 2-0 series lead for the Nashville Predators. I'm sure we will continue to talk about that. Kevin Woodley is going to join us at 1:30 to wrap up the show. Really excited to get his thoughts on that. But, Drancer, to turn our attention to, you know, the other 40 players who are going to be involved in this series, or at least in this game tonight, what were you going to be watching for before the Thatcher Demko news kind of eclipsed everything else that we could possibly be talking about or thinking about going into this game? What were you going to be watching for and looking for in Game 2 between the Canucks and the Preds?
Before we all became Thatcher Demko Seagulls? Demko?
Yes. Although, is it really being a Demko Seagull when it's like the major news? Like, oh. Ellie Friedman was on the Pat McAfee show talking about it.
I mean, it's a big deal. I'm not saying it's not. It's just like the trade seagulls. Like, it's not like the trade deadline isn't big news.
It's true.
It's not about whether it's called
for.
But
I think of the trade seagulls.
You don't think it's called for that seagulls just like want food?
Yeah, no. Mine. Mine.
They should all go on a diet.
Wow.
I think, I associate the trade seagulls, though, with it being like 2 months before the trade deadline. You know what I mean? But that's still, it's the front burner issue. Whereas this is like absolutely the front burner issue, as much as I want us to talk about something else right now.
Yeah, why are you trying to steer it this way? Canucks fans, you know what? You know what's amazing is the disparate reactions in our inbox.
Mm-hmm.
This is horrible news, texts in one unsigned texter. All this time and energy put into this, and now we are going to lose in six. We are going to be outscored by 82 tonight. My goodness. That's one end of the spectrum.
By 82.
That's one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, we have, should the Canucks be able to weather the storm and win games with DeSmith when Demko gets healthy again? Should they go back to him or just ride the hot hand? That's the opposite end of the spectrum.
Goalie controversy, baby.
They say Canucks fans are polarized, and never more so than when reacting to really tough injury news. So what was I going to watch for? I was going to watch for a couple things. One is the O'Reilly soft match. Okay, so Canucks didn't do a hard match on Ryan O'Reilly. Elias Lindholm and JT Miller played pretty nearly equal amount of time, with Lindholm having a slight edge head-to-head against the O'Reilly line. And the O'Reilly line didn't play badly defensively. At the end of the game, they have minus threes across the board. But it's like that Lindholm shot, they're not going to lose sleep about giving that shot up. What was the other one? The other one was the empty netter was one of them.
Yeah.
So you don't care about that. And then the other one was the forechecking shift, which was really an error on the defense pairs more than it was on the forwards. Like, I don't think we'd look at that and say O'Reilly had a bad defensive game despite the minus three. What that top line really failed to do was generate scoring chances. And Nashville cannot win this series and cannot, for sure, exploit Casey DeSmith, right? If they're not getting shots and chances at the top of their lineup, which they didn't last night. Can Vancouver continue not just to win the matchup at the top of the lineup, which they did, but severely
dominate?
Yeah. Well, because they didn't dominate the O'Reilly line. That's not right. Shots were like 4-1.
Oh, okay. You're talking about specifically the matchup against
with O'Reilly.
Okay. I was just thinking about like what Miller and Hughes did in total in the game. Like, I would say they
through the first 40 minutes.
Sure.
They only dominated McCarron, man.
Yeah, but I would say overall they had a really dominant impact on that game.
Against the fourth line they did.
But whatever. Continue.
I'm just saying, like, it wasn't dominant up and down the lineup. The Pettersson line struggled.
No,
right?
No. I'm talking about Miller and Hughes. We can get into Pettersson.
Even then, it was really the first 40 minutes where they were completely dominant when those guys were on the ice together. And that slowed in the third period. A little bit, but, you know, that's also because the Canucks were defending the lead and on and on. Anyway, sorry, I agree with you. Yes, the Canucks won the matchup at the top of the lineup, but really they especially limited what danger the Predators' top line can offer. I'm curious to see if that continues. If it does, then DeSmith's going to be in a really good position here, right? Because those are the Predators' forwards most likely to do damage, pick corners, beat you with fancy stuff. If the Canucks are able to limit their zone time, their shots, their scoring chances, man, they will be giving their goaltender a significant head start tonight.
Okay, let's talk about Pettersson a little bit. And the Pettersson line is really how I want to frame it, because to me, that's one of the big questions. You know, I'm curious to see, as you said, like the matchup of the O'Reilly line, how that O'Reilly line is used. Are they out there more consistently against the JT Miller line? You know, how does Andrew Brunette kind of adjust to that? But I think no matter how that deployment and that matchup game kind of settles between O'Reilly, Miller, and Elias Lindholm, and how those minutes get divvied up, there are going to be advantageous, or at least potentially advantageous minutes out there for Elias Pettersson and his line. And to me, that's one of the big questions. And even more so now with Casey DeSmith getting the start, is like, what happens when one of your star players go down? You need your other star players to be even better. One of the big questions tonight is, can Elias Pettersson's line punish the middle of Nashville's lineup, right? Whoever they end up playing against, it's probably not going to be Ryan O'Reilly. It's probably not going to be a lot of Roman Josi and Ryan McDonough. Should be a matchup in Vancouver's favor. Can they make that a reality? We heard from Rick Tocchet yesterday, you know, thought that line was just okay. They were a little disconnected, weren't great on the forecheck. I expect Nils Höglander to be better. I'm also curious to see if it's Sam Lafferty still there, or if maybe Ilya Mikheyev gets moved up. But whatever the configuration is, I think that line needs to find a way to, at the very least, be spending a lot of time in Nashville's defensive zone tonight.
You would certainly hope so. I would expect we see a fair bit of Pettersson against that Novak line, because I think the Predators will probably have liked what they saw, and I haven't seen how they skated today yet, but the Sisson-Zucker-Evangelista line was incredible, and I'll be really... So that's another thing I'm going to be watching for, is how does Brunette deploy a 5-on-5 line that he kind of put together on the fly in the last game, and they really took it to Vancouver in those minutes. Is that something where they like look to even try it? Do you try it against the Miller line, given how the McCarron matchup went? Do you try that against the Miller line? Hope that you can get more from O'Reilly versus Lindholm.
And then
try to get sort of Novak and McCarron out against a Pettersson line that maybe you're coming out of game one, if you're from Nashville's perspective and thinking, you know, as dangerous as Pettersson is, we think we can do damage in those minutes, or at least we think we can limit the damage.
That's an interesting way to look at it, because if Brunette is, for some reason, reluctant to really lean into the O'Reilly-Miller matchup, right? Like, if one of his priorities is keep O'Reilly away from Miller and use him in other situations, maybe that's not his plan B. Maybe plan B is, as you said, Colton Sissons. If he was willing to try Michael McCarron in those minutes, he's probably willing to try Colton Sissons in those minutes, right? And it's not as if they got blown out in game one doing that. But again, then you look who that, you know, you look who that leaves for Elias Pettersson to match up with, right? And it's Tommy Novak, who they've used in a pretty sheltered role this year, and it's Michael McCarron, who really struggled to contain JT Miller. And that's just, as much as we can sit here and point at Elias Pettersson's line mates, right, and I think very fairly take that into consideration when we're discussing how much she's producing, if the flip side of that is you're also getting the easiest deployment of any of Vancouver's top three lines in terms of who you're playing against, like, it's got to balance out at a certain point, and that should be an area where they have a chance to do some damage.
I'd push back a little bit on the McCarron struggled to limit the damage against Miller. Not that you're wrong, you're not, but the way that Nashville would look at it, right, is not that we got ventilated in those minutes because they outshot us 7-0. It was that we didn't get outscored in those minutes, and because we were able to rely on our fourth line being out there occasionally against Miller, that created more favorable circumstances elsewhere in the lineup. And really what we got to do is capitalize on that, as opposed to going away from a matchup that ultimately didn't hurt us.
I just think you're playing with fire, man.
Massive amounts
like
of fire.
Like, if it's one thing to be like, hey, we held the fort even though we were you know, under fire for all of those minutes, like, at a certain point, Miller's going to convert those chances. That line's going to convert some chances there.
If the shoe was on the other foot and a Canucks head coach had taken that approach in game one, we'd absolutely be taking the, like, I don't know about that tone.
100%.
But we'd also be pointing out that it didn't hurt them.
Yeah.
You know, so
I think that's the job that it let's say it plays out like that.
This is how Green always did it, like with Beagle and Mott and Schaller or whomever, right? Like, there was always a punted matchup. It always looked ugly. And sometimes it worked, you know, and that's one of the ways that overmatched teams or teams that are, you know, not necessarily as deep as their opponent sometimes do it. You sometimes punt a matchup.
Yeah.
I would say at the very least, McCarron versus Miller wasn't like a decisive Canucks win. I don't even know if Nashville will come out of game one thinking we have to go away from it as like an urgent priority.
If they get that, if the Canucks get that again, then it's incumbent on JT Miller and Brock Besser and Pugh Suter to punish that.
To do damage.
To absolutely punish them for doing that. And if it's Elias Pettersson in that situation, and then this is a guy who, how much have we talked about like his ability to finish chances? Not just to generate chances, but to impact how his team is finishing chances. And so, like, I agree with you. It's one thing for Nashville to say, all right, we're willing to be, you know, under fire in our own end in those minutes as long as we don't break. Elias Pettersson should be the guy who can make them break, right? Who can punish them if you're giving him chance after chance after chance in the offensive zone. So that's going to be a huge deal for me in this game. And just in general, you know, I think the Canucks need to establish that forecheck and spend as much time in the offensive zone as possible tonight. I know you can't play differently because Casey DeSmith is in net. It's always important for the Canucks. It's even more important to be playing as far away from their own net as possible tonight. Okay, we heard briefly from Rick Tocchet earlier in the show, just a couple of his comments on Thatcher Demko, but he had some other things to say, and I think it's worth revisiting what he had to say about Thatcher Demko anyway. So here is Rick Tocchet speaking to the media at Rogers Arena earlier today.
Well, he skated yesterday. He's not going to play tonight. We're going to evaluate him today on something. It wasn't the old injury, and that's all I really got for you guys. You know, it's a day-to-day thing.
Can you give us a sense of when it may have happened?
Yesterday, I think. I'm not quite sure. That's what it's. I don't have a timeline exactly, so I don't want to speculate.
You said it happened. It may have happened yesterday in practice.
It might have been in the game, but I'm not quite sure because he skated yesterday. I don't have the exact timeline. That's why I don't want to speculate whether it's, you know, this time or whatever.
How equipped is this team to deal with it, given they've just dealt with it?
Well, I think all year we've had people step up in and out of the lineups. Casey played a big game against Edmonton, what was it, 10 days ago? A huge game to win the division. So he's done it all year for us. So just moving March forward, guys are excited about tonight's game.
The mentality of playing in the playoffs is one challenge. How does losing your starter, how is that a challenge for you as a coach to help your players?
Well, I always go into the playoffs, and in the speeches, you're going to use 28. If you're going to go far, you're going to use 28 guys. Now, I get certain stars and stuff, I get it, but to go deep, you have to use 28 guys in your lineup. It just mostly goes that far, so you're going to have people step up and the team step up, so that's the mentality.
And even without the Demko question, you come off a big emotional game one, you go into game two. You know, what is the challenge there for a player, for a coach, for a team?
Well, I think for sure, like, you know, we want to feed off the crowd again and bring it again. I don't think you change your game if there's certain guys, you know, lineup changes. You just don't. You know, we know the way we have to play, whether whoever's in the net, whoever's whatever line you're on. I mean, that's the mentality you have to do in the playoffs. That's just the way it is. You just march along.
Rick, beyond goaltending, any other lineup changes for tonight?
No.
Is that sticking with a winning lineup? Is that strategic? Did you like every skater the other night that earned the opportunity to get back in there?
Well, I don't believe you can't change the lineup. If a guy stinks, take him out, right? I mean, let's face facts. But I didn't think anybody stunk. I thought a lot of guys, whether they were just okay, they were neutral, which is okay sometimes. But there's three or four or five guys I think that we need to play better, but I didn't think it deserved the lineup change.
Will Lafferty start with Petey again? Or
I don't know. That could be an in-change type of thing. I'm going to do an in-change thing like I did last game.
Rick, just back to Demko, the fact that he's missing, he's been helping you all year winning games.
when you say that you're not going to change the way you play, do you at the same time expect that your best players, knowing that a key member of the team helping that's helping you win games is not there, will put on their shoulders a responsibility of doing more? Or is it a trap to think that way?
No, I just believe that you just play the same way. I mean, because Demers and Ned, you're going to toe drag at the blue line. I mean, no, you shouldn't do it anyways. Like, that's you know, that's one of our staples. We don't do, you know, try not to do those dumb things, right? Whether Demers and Ned or whoever's in net, you just don't, you try to be, play the right way. So why would we change? Like, all of a sudden we're going to dump the puck in more because, you know, we have Casey in net? I mean, no, we're going to play the same way.
Rick, do you have a history as a player or a coach where in the playoffs your starter suddenly injured and somebody else had to come back in? Can you regale us with something?
I think Kenny Reggett went in Pittsburgh. DeBrasso went down, which was huge. He was big. I'm trying to think. Why am I going blank? I know Kenny Reggett for Brasso. That was a big one for me. I wasn't there, but the next year, was it Pietrangelo? What's his name? The goalie there. I wasn't there, though, but he was unreal for Pittsburgh. So there's a lot of the good stories.
This looks like a real prudent trade now. I mean, you knew Casey from his Pittsburgh days, and he seems to have a certain pedigree. You guys just didn't go acquire a backup. You acquired a guy who's played a number of games. How confident are you that he can just pick it up? And go
I'm real confident. I love his demeanor. Very well-liked guy. I mean, you know. This is, you know, anytime you get in the playoffs, there's stories. And, you know, he's looking for to be a contributor to this team. And we expect the way he's played all year for us, really solid hockey. We're not looking for him to be spectacular. We're looking to be Casey.
The emotions of game one were through the roof, 70-plus hits. It's probably going to be even amped up more tonight. How do you maintain that physicality and keep it on the right side of the line, stay out of the penalty box? Because as good as your penalty kill was in game one, you know they're going to adjust on the power play.
Yeah, I think when you want to be hitting, you want to hit. You know, and, you know, we all, you know, I love hits, but I think you got to do it with good detail. Shoulder into the chest, you know, no elbows up. I mean, a big hit is, you know, like Big Z there had some nice hits. They were legal hits. That's what I want. You start running around, elbows up, jumping and stuff. I mean, that's not really, maybe 10, 20 years ago, you can do that. You can't do that nowadays. It's not really tough hockey. So I think we want to play a physical game, but obviously within the rules. I mean, you have to. Stay out of the box.
Sorry. You spoke about a handful of guys you wanted to see more from yesterday. How do you and your staff motivate those guys up for a game like tonight?
I don't think you have to motivate them at this time of the year. I think you got to show them some stuff. You know, the coaches were busy yesterday showing some individual clips. And it wasn't an effort thing. It was just kind of in the wrong spots. Maybe some tough decisions, like not bad decisions, some decisions that you might want to think about. A couple of diving in here and there. And I think it's just showing them on video. They know. I mean, you have to pound in their head. I mean, really, it's a two-minute meeting. You know, they get it.
I guess, like, if they are able to make the changes necessary that you're looking for and that they're looking for as well, how beneficial is that as the playoffs go on here?
Well, they've done in the past. That's the one thing I love about this team is throughout the year is, you know, they whether it's an individual or a couple of guys or whatever, they always the team's really done a good job of bouncing back. So I'm not really worried about that.
Game one, your message to the fans was be loud. Do you have a message to the fans for game two?
I don't know if they can be louder, but can they bring the same level? That was pretty special. You know, that's you go a little louder than that, they might be not speaking for a week. It'd be tough to yell that loud.
One more here.
Asked Pettersson after game one what he thinks he can do better tonight, and he said move his feet. I'm curious what you saw from him and his line where they can be better tonight.
Yeah, I think just more connected and move his feet. Like when he gets the puck, like go. Like he's a talented guy. Find that good ice and make those option plays, you know. And then obviously the PP, you know, he's going to get some I think he's going to get some good looks tonight, and he's got to shoot it. He's got a hell of a shot, so don't defer, shoot it.
That is Canucks head coach Rick Tocchet, asking the fans to bring that same energy as they brought in game one. And I also had to laugh to answer it, you know, the question about, are you just keeping your lineup together because you won? And Tocchet saying, yeah, no, if a player stinks, you take him out. But no one stunk in game one.
No one stunk. High praise.
There's something about the phrase stinks. That's making me laugh. If a guy stings, I'd take him out.
Especially when it applies to hockey players. Like, the moment hockey players leave, like, the dressing room, there's, like, fans and deodorizers everywhere. Smells terrible.
Yeah.
So, like, if that's your standard, you're scratching everybody. We've got a whole new lineup tonight. 18 new skaters. Everyone stunk.
Oh, dear. But anyways, no one stunk enough to get pulled out of the lineup for Rick Tocchet in that last one.
I think that's right, by the way.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, now he was asked the follow-up, will Lafferty start with Pettersson, which I think is a totally fair question, right? Like, if you were looking at a place to make a lineup move.
Wow, it's fair if you're poking for the negatives. Sorry, I didn't expect you to laugh at that. I didn't think it was funny.
Anyways, I think that's totally fair, right? If you're looking at a place where a lineup move might happen, to kind of zero in on Sam Lafferty. And Rick Tocchet was non-committal on whether Lafferty will be playing in that same spot. Kind of said, you know, it might be some in-game switch-ups as well. And I think, you know, as we highlighted, the discrepancy in ice time between Elias Pettersson, just at 5-on-5, right? Not even taking into account the power play, just at 5-on-5, big discrepancy in ice time between Elias Pettersson and his, you know, theoretical line mates in Nils Höglander and Sam Lafferty. So I wonder if that's going to be a theme in this series, right? And until and unless those guys really get going and are at the level Tocchet wants, if we keep seeing those shifts, whether it's Lotto line, whether it's other ways for him to get Elias Pettersson on the ice more than Nils Höglander and Sam Lafferty, sounds like something that we could see again tonight based on that commentary from Rick Tocchet.
What do you make of Quinn Hughes and Hronek's ice time in game one? Because it was very modest.
Yes. I think the rest of the blue line was playing really well, to be honest. So I don't know that they felt like they had to lean on those guys necessarily. I think that's all I would draw from it right now. I mean, it's surprising because I know you and I had talked about, like, oh, get ready to see some eye-popping numbers in terms of time on ice from Quinn Hughes once the playoffs roll around. And obviously that didn't happen. But I think it probably was made a lot easier because they were getting good performances from the other four defensemen, not on that top pair.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I think you're right for the most part. I'm curious to see what that, like, I'm curious to just track that as we go here. Is Tocchet trying to pace himself? Is it, what's the motivation? You know, there's some things about it that actually concern me, to be totally honest with you, because it was almost too low. And I don't mean that from a tactical standpoint. I mean it from a, like, managing your player's rest perspective or you know, managing the risk that you're taking on from how you're using a player. Like, it was so low that I side-eyed it, which isn't to say, like, I don't want to speculate about anything or anything beyond just my reaction to that number. It was almost low enough that I found it suspect. And so I'm really curious to see what it looks like tonight. I'm really curious to see how Vancouver deploys their D. I hope you're right, and that it was a reflection of how Myers and company. What are you giggling about?
I'm a good Mike, the urologist from Brockville, just sent us a good tweet featuring, you remember the show The Critic? His tagline was, "It stinks."
Oh, right.
And he sent us a clip of Rick Tocchet looking at game tape from Andre Kuzmenko of the Canucks this year.
The Critic.
The guy saying it stinks.
Love it.
So, good job. Good work, Mike the urologist.
So Mike the urologist with the Critic meme. Someone's gonna text in something from Duckman next. We're gonna
doing all the adult animation from the 90s.
Yeah, what was Teletoon or whatever it was called? Channel 50, that rocked.
Yeah. Well, it's the Cartoon Network in the States, but it was Teletoon here, I believe. Yeah. I think you're right.
It stinks.
Wow.
All right, Let's take a break. Ryan Clark will get his reaction to the Demko news and talk about some of the other playoff series happening as well right now. Ryan Clark from ESPN next on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drance here. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet. What are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And we are now very pleased to be joined through the magic of video conferencing. He's been waiting patiently on camera. We can see him. This is fantastic. Our guy from ESPN covering the NHL, Ryan Clark. Ryan, thank you for doing this. How are you?
Good, good. How are you two? And also, thank you for having me. And I hope this isn't the worst light in the world, but this is my hotel room, so here we go. It's not as cool of a studio that has Canucks talk on the back or an old-timey skate, but, you know, you do what you can.
It looks great.
And where are you coming to us from, Ryan? Where are you off to covering playoff hockey at the moment?
Dallas, Texas.
Let's go. What a game you saw last night. Let's start there, actually.
Sure.
What did you make of Mark Stone's heroic return against the odds? What did you make of game one of that series?
Mark Stone's return was multi-layered in so many different ways. It starts off with the goal, and then it's the booing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the booing, even the intermission while he's talking to Leah Hexall. And for the people who didn't see the clip of it, the arena was darkened for intermission because they were about to do something, and there was a spotlight on Mark Stone and Leah Hextall, and someone noticed, and then more people noticed, and then Mark Stone was booed throughout the entirety of his interview. But then even when you look at the later goals, the fact that Tomas Hertl scored, Noah Hanifin had two assists, they're there because of Mark Stone, the injury, LTIR, and then you look at the way the game ended and how Mark Stone played those crucial defensive minutes. In terms of the game itself overall, it's a series – that game just showed why this series is so hard to predict, because one of those teams in the Golden Knights is defending Stanley Cup champions, that they can withstand pressure, they can get goals, they can get all sorts of contributions from different people in their lineup. But then if you're the Dallas Stars, you've shown why you've been able to come close, not close the way you'd like in terms of winning games consistently, but close enough to the Vegas Golden Knights that now it's another game that you are left asking questions, and one of them being, what can you do in game two to even the series before you return to Vegas?
I don't want to say they're in trouble, right? Because it's just one game, and yeah, you lose at home. So that's a little different than when you're the road team and you lose that game one. But I think there was so much wondering about how Vegas would look, right? And okay, they had Hurdle in, how, you know, he scores a goal, Mark Stone comes back and scores a goal. Did that cause you to kind of upgrade what you expect from Vegas in the rest of this series, just kind of seeing them hit the ground running like that in game one?
It seemed like game one for Vegas was more about how are all the pieces going to fit, because Tomas Hurdle and Mark Stone had never played together. Chandler Stephenson's had plenty of time with Mark Stone. He's had minutes with Hurdle, but it was a question of how is this going to look? Even how is Pietrangelo and Hanifin going to look? Because while they'd had some time together, Alex Pietrangelo's been out of the lineup for a bit. So it seemed like it was more about how will this work, because you know the formula for success works. You know they have 20 players from last year's team that was there. But there were questions, among them being how did the new players fit, but also how would Logan Thompson look? And so, yes, on the third goal that he had, and Mark Stone said it perfectly, that's something that he would want back. But when you look at how Logan Thompson played in the second and third period, he bailed them out of some situations, because when you look at the shot share of the Dallas Stars in those second and third periods, it ended up being around 56% to 57%. So the Stars were controlling possession, but it goes back to something Jonathan Marchessault said last night, which is he thought they were playing well, but when you look at the shot disparity, it really reinforces how their adjustments Vegas has to make. But again, what you saw from the Golden Knights, it goes back to, it's not that you looked at the series and thought, okay, are they at a disadvantage? It's just more of how is this all going to fit? Because even last night, let's say Vegas wins this series, which could realistically happen. Yes, it's a lower seed being a higher seed, but it's not really one you can call an upset, because you look at Vegas's roster and there's nothing that seems like a minnow about them. They are very much a shark.
With the Logan Thompson discussion, I want to pivot and discuss Thatcher Demko. So, news has come out of this market that Thatcher Demko will not play in game two. Everyone is responding very calmly. How does it switch from the outside looking in, Ryan? How does Demko's absence and the fact that he's now questionable over the balance of the series reportedly impact how you view the Canucks versus Predators matchup?
Maybe a little bit differently, but this is what it comes back to. it's a couple things. The first is the Canucks have had plenty of games without Thatcher Demko. They know what they're getting. They know sort of what they need Smith to be. So there's that. The second part is you look at goaltending tandems in the league right now. There's a reason more teams are going to tandems, because asking a goaltender to be able to start 60 to 65 games of a season, Thatcher Demko is one of the rare ones who can do it when healthy. But also, that's the third component of this, is when healthy. We've all talked about the potential of Thatcher Demko and what he could be, but it's come with that understanding that there might be a point when he gets injured. Granted, that's the case for every player in the NHL. But with goalies, you have to have a backup plan, and it's why more teams are becoming, let's say, prudent. Not that they weren't before, but especially now, of having backups, even third goaltenders that they can have in the AHL, who in the event something like this happens, they are ready to go. So if you're the Canucks, you know what you have in your other options. You know how to win games without Thatcher Demko, but also you're going against a Nashville team, and this got brought up last night too, that for all the things UC Saros has done, he's had his challenges in his own right, but also, as we've seen in this Western Conference playoff series through just one game, whoever scores the most in the last goals win. So if you're the Canucks, you seem like you're in a good position to be able to go out in game two and possibly take a 2-0 series lead back to Nashville. Either way, whether you lose or win tonight, it's going to be a split, or you're up going to Nashville.
Yeah, it's an interesting point about how just teams in general have started to build their rosters kind of expecting, hey, this could happen in the playoffs. We need to have a guy who's ready to go. I do think it's interesting with the Canucks, because prior to this year, Demko was such kind of a talisman for them, right? Where it was like, okay, if Demko is on, we have a chance. If not, we could be in trouble. Now, that's changed a lot this year, but I am kind of curious to see. This feels like the moment where they can, like, fully prove, okay, we've put that version of the Canucks behind us. Even in a playoff series with Demko out, we were able to rally and do the job in front of Casey DeSmith. But I think it's going to be, as much as it's a test of Casey DeSmith, it's going to be a really fascinating kind of psychological test for the Canucks players as well, right? To overcome that adversity early in the playoffs and show, hey, we're a different team than the guys that used to rely so heavily on Thatcher Demko.
Well, it's that, but it's also something we've talked about on this program throughout the course of the season, which is the five-player defensive structure. You think about how much it's changed under Rick Tocchet, but also the moves that they've made in the last year, whether it was getting Philip Ronick, Carson Soucy, Ian Cole, Nikita Zadorov, you get Elias Lindholm. These are all moves that fortify the two-way element of what the Canucks are. And it's shown that this is a team that, when it has Thatcher Demko healthy, it's even more difficult to beat. But even when Thatcher Demko isn't at his best or he's injured, you can win with Casey DeSmith or Archer Siloffs and still win games, because for all the things we can say about the Canucks, few teams have been as consistent as the Canucks this season. They had one stretch where they lost four games in a row, and that was it. So you know the formula works. It's just a question of, can this work in the playoffs? And that's a question they were going to have to answer no matter who's in that.
With the way the league is trending, right? Both teams that made the cup final used two goaltenders in the first round a year ago. You know, the Avalanche that won in 2022, we all know, turned to Francouz for the Western Conference final. Is this the new reality that you might need to be able to win some games, maybe even win a full series with a backup goaltender in the contemporary NHL if you're going to go deep?
It looks that way. You listed a bunch of different examples, but as much as everyone says, well, you have to pick an option at some point, that's the thing about the postseason. It's about finding who you believe gives you that best option to win. We saw that with Vegas last season. Yes, it was injuries that opened the door, but even then, Adin Hill, once he got the opportunity, he was one of their best players. And when you talk to different general managers throughout this league, and we did a story on this not that long ago, it was about a year ago, actually, I believe it was Jim Neal who made the point that when you look at how much a season has changed with travel, with expansion, with all the demands that players have on them now, you absolutely have to look at getting a second goaltender, because it's something that's going to benefit you. It's about getting a third goaltender in the event something happens with your first goaltender or your second goaltender. And so while, yes, teams would like continuity, the reality of it is you need to be able to have a backup plan. And so when we've talked about what teams have the best shot of winning, whether it's the Canucks, the Jets, the Stars, the Golden Knights, the Rangers, the Hurricanes, what they all have in common is there's a level of depth that they can provide. The Bruins, even for all the questions people had about the Bruins down the middle, they've been able to answer those questions. It's about having depth. And so there's that expectation with the forward lines and defensive pairings. It only makes sense that it's that way with goaltending. It's just the difference now is teams are trying to be more calculated with how much they spend on goaltending, which is why when you look at the LA Kings the last few years, it's been one of those things where, yes, they've been able to make it work financially and they've been able to create depth. But of course, it's a matter of can you get beyond the Oilers in the first round? But this is something we're seeing more teams doing and with a lot of reasons.
So goaltending in the spotlight in another series in the Western Conference as well, and that's for Colorado and Winnipeg. And I know a lot of dissatisfaction from Colorado Avalanche fan with Georgiev after he allows 7 goals against the Winnipeg Jets. Now, look, a lot of those were really, really high-quality scoring chances from Winnipeg as well. How fair do you think kind of that frustration and that finger-pointing at Georgiev is after that performance and that loss in Game 1?
It's complicated, isn't it? Because mm-hmm. when you look at the amount of shots the Avalanche gave up, it wasn't a ton. It really wasn't. It wasn't like Connor Hellebuyck, who faced a lot more. So that part of the structure worked, but in the sense of giving up high danger chances, that's what got the Avs in a ton of trouble. You look through the goals, and there's a pattern. Now, yes, there's one where Georgiev plays the puck, things go awry, and it leads to an easy goal. But it's really about how do you eliminate those high danger chances. That's one of the strengths of Colorado system, but again, it also goes back to what makes the Winnipeg Jets so dangerous. And in terms of what the answer is for the Avalanche, it's going to be what it is for every team in that situation. How do you find ways to play more consistent with your goaltender up front, but also how do you find a way to get more consistency out of your goaltender? And what makes this even more of a fascinating subject is you think about what the revolving door has been in Denver for goalies over the last 6 years. There was a time when it was Semyon Varlamov. Then it was Pavel Francouz mixed in with Philip Grubauer. And then while Francouz was the constant, you saw Darcy Kuemper come in. Of course, you've seen Alexander Georgiev come in. And the end result has been, yes, they won a cup with Kuemper, but they've had goaltenders who've been able to get them far without really having those overwhelming bad games. And now you've seen Alexander Georgiev have it. And there's certainly a conversation for people to have about, hey, when Justus Annunen is healthy, does he deserve to be in net? And so to see how that's going to work out is going to be fascinating because, again, on the other end, whether he gives up 6 goals or he gives up 2, you're looking at a goalie who could conceivably win the Vezina this year, someone who people think is one of, if not the best goalie in the league. And when we've talked about what makes Winnipeg so threatening, there's a lot of reasons, but among them is Connor Hellebuyck. And again, it just goes to show how if you can find those sorts of goalies, everyone tries to, but you can't, that if you can find those sort of goalies who can give you continuity, it's going to give you an advantage over most.
The McDavid show last night was stunning and interesting to me from the perspective of this prevailing sentiment locally, right? Because the Kings took 7 of 8 points from the Canucks. The Canucks beat the Oilers in all 4 of their matchups. And I feel like there's this belief almost locally, and this is me reading way too much into it, that the Pacific Division top 3 are like rock, paper, scissors. Like the Canucks can beat the Oilers can beat the Kings, and the Kings can beat the Canucks, and it doesn't go the other way around. After watching what McDavid did, I mean, how imposing is this Edmonton team relative to the rest of the Western Conference field, in your view?
They're like the Canucks in that you have questions about how this is going to work, because what you saw last season against Vegas presented a lot of questions, both goaltending, defensive structure. Can you get secondary and tertiary scoring options beyond Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl? Because something that we've talked about a lot in our previews at ESPN has been, and those losses to the Golden Knights, if it's not for Zach Hyman and Warren Fogel, no one beyond McDavid or Draisaitl scores for the Oilers. So how you get that remedied is a big thing. Seeing what they did against the Kings, yes, it's beginning to answer those questions, but it's really just more about how is this going to look under Chris Knobloch in the later rounds? Because what we've seen in the regular season since he's taken over is a team that has not only gotten back to being proficient with goals, But goal prevention has become one of the hallmarks of what they've done, whether it be through the five-player defensive structure, what they've done with Stuart Skinner and sort of reaffirming what made them feel like he's their long-term goalie. And it's really now just a matter of seeing, like, how does that compare to other teams? Whereas if you're the LA Kings, the joke has kind of become, how do you get a first-round series and you don't play the Edmonton Oilers? Because it's now going on 3 years, and again, this might be jumping the gun a little bit here, but let's say if you're the Kings and you lose this series, if you're Rob Blake in that franchise, what questions are you now answering or having to ask yourselves to answer about what it's going to take to get beyond the first round? Because it's been a decade, and not only has it been a decade, but you think about what they've done to get to this point. They've built the youth movement through Byfield, through Anderson. They were able to get guys like Doughty and Kopitar to stay. They've made the moves to go get Kevin Fiala and Victor Arvidsson and Philippe Danault and Pierre-Luc Dubois. And yet the end result is they could be staring at not getting out of the first round for a third straight year. And it leads to some serious questions, especially in a West when you've seen Dallas make strides. You're seeing Vancouver make strides. Winnipeg looks like it could make strides. Vegas and Colorado have made the ultimate strides, and you're trying to do it again. And you're trying to get into this conversation knowing Nashville thinks he could do the same thing. And not to be funny, but if the Blues can get some things answered in the offseason, that's another team you have to consider in the sense of who could be in the playoff conversation a year from now.
Ryan, I know you had a really great feature that went up at ESPN today on Nathan MacKinnon. And of course, you know, he's been a fascinating subject all year. One of the handful of leading candidates for the Hart Trophy, which is, of course, such a close race. And, you know, with him having this type of career year, which is saying something because he's had so many good seasons in his career. I know they've already won a cup there with Nathan MacKinnon, you know, playing for the Avs. But how much pressure is there on the Avs to kind of make this season from Nathan MacKinnon count and not have it end with like a disappointing early exit after he had this phenomenal campaign for the team?
It seems like it's less about doing it in the context of MacKinnon's season, but just more, how do you make this window open? So you think about the story Daniel Nugent-Bowman just had about Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl and them being in their late 20s and with contract situations, could this be it? If you're the Avalanche, you've got players signed under long-term deals. There's a thought that they could be good for a while, but also it's sort of that idea of how do you find a way to maximize these opportunities as much as you can. So it seems it's less about how do you complete this season, one that has led to some questions about where MacKinnon could rank amongst all-time Avs. It seems like, again, it's more about how do you find a way to maximize this window, because he's going to be 29 in September. Mikko Rantanen will be 28. Kale McCarr will be, 26? So you still got your core under 30, but you have players like Landeskog who are over 30. And so it's about, if you're the Avs, trying to find a way to maximize that. Because, again, when you look at the future, the Stars look like they're going to be a problem for a while with that young core. The Canucks are doing the same thing. For all the conversations that we've had about the Coyotes going to Utah, they're building a farm system out there with people like Daryl Plandowski, who was involved in Tampa, that has made their farm system one of the more formidable ones. And even though they seem like they're at a distance now, if the Anaheim Ducks can figure it out, and let's say they draft a Macklin Celebrini, or even the Blackhawks draft a Macklin Celebrini, in this NHL where more teams are trying to find ways to build through the draft, and then within 5 years, kind of like what we saw with the Rangers, go from, hey, you're in a lottery, to now you're in a playoff position, it makes those windows even smaller. Because the last thing I'll say is, you think about a couple years ago when the Winnipeg Jets and the Nashville Predators looked like they were going to have dominion over the Western Conference. It felt like the Jets were just bringing up guys left, right, and center, almost like they were a video game team where you're like, damn, this dude's good and this dude's good. And it's been a struggle for them. And so it's about, how do you maximize these windows? Because that's another lesson a team like the Carolina Hurricanes, they're also learning as well.
Ryan, really appreciate it. This was great being able to see you with your insights not in person, but through the magic of video.
I'll be honest, though, I spent the entire interview being like, I wonder if his insults are going to hurt more if I can see him. And then you didn't take a shot, my dude.
I
was bracing the whole time.
No. There was no point. Like, this has been fun, and enjoyable. I thought about it when you were like, hey, when you take a glance at these three teams kind of being in this three card Monty, and maybe I'm reading too much into things. And that's like Thomas Drance reading too much into things. And next thing you know, it's a day that ends in Y. So I wasn't prepared, but because you brought it up, there you go. So it worked out for everyone. And Canuck Central is still on the air, because I can understand if they're like, you know what, after this, we're good.
Ryan, appreciate the time as always. We'll talk soon.
Thanks for doing this, bud.
You got it, guys. Take care.
That is ESPN's Ryan Clark.
Going to be with us all playoffs.
Yes, absolutely.
Thrilled.
I'm very excited. And he's covering the Stars and the Golden Knights. That series should be a ton of fun.
I'm not kidding, and I don't throw it around lightly. Ryan Clark's one of the best hockey writers we have on the planet right now. Just an immensely talented guy. The best.
He's awesome. Glad to have him along, and looking forward to more of his insights as he travels around and covers these games. I know Dallas lost, but how sick was it to see Logan Stankoven pull the Mark Stone on Mark Stone? That was awesome. So good.
I mean, you know how I feel about Logan Stankoven, but seeing him do it on a big stage, it like almost hurts
and just
now.
Like it was against Mark Stone. It was so cool.
It was so cool.
Good for him. BC guy. Shout out to Kamloops' own Logan Stankoven. Oh, you're so...
I honestly can't enjoy the Stankoven success. This is going to happen to me with Benson, too. Like, there's like a level of guy who I just think is so obviously good, and then they fall way too far, and then they succeed. Braden Point. I felt like this about Braden Point for 10 years, and I just find it annoying. I like them so much that I find their success annoying, because I'm like, man, I look good. I look good here.
All right. I get it. I get it. But I also can cheer for the BC guy.
Yeah, me too.
I know. I know you're just joking.
I'm partly joking. honestly, his success is so... Him and Wyatt Johnston are like a skating high-danger scoring chance.
Yeah.
It's just like at will. I also still think Dallas is winning that series going away.
Yeah, I'm not... I shouldn't say I'm not worried, but I think Dallas is still... They've got every chance to win that series. We got to take a break here.
Okay, really quick. What did you think about Carolina out Vancouver?
Carolina is outrageous, man. They're really good.
That was sick.
They're way better than the Islanders.
Yep.
Okay, Kevin Woodley. Deep dive into Thatcher Demko and Casey DeSmith with Kevin Woodley up next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drance live from the Kintec studio.
Before we get to Woodley, I don't want to keep him waiting for long, but I didn't realize how much baggage Nashville sports fans have about backup goaltenders and backup QBs. But I'm seeing a lot of like backup goalies against the Preds and then a photo of a brick wall. Or
doesn't every hockey team think that, though, to a degree?
But it takes a particular Nashville character here. Here's another comment. Whatever the hockey equivalent is of some freshman third-string QB lighting up Vandy for 300-plus yards in his first-ever start. SEC baggage connects to backup goaltender baggage for the Nashville Predators fan base.
I don't think you're allowed to be upset about Vandy football losses. Like, they're the designated academic punching bag in the SEC. It's like, oh, Vandy lost a football game? It's like, yeah, no kidding. You're Vanderbilt. So you're there to do. Anyways, shout out to Vanderbilt, the Commodores. All right, let's get into it with our next guest. Perfect guest to have on the show today, Kevin Woodley from In Goal Magazine, NHL.com, and he is a presentation of White Rock Hyundai. You want to say something?
I do. I want to ask the first question. Can I get the first question?
Oh, go nuts. Let me say hello.
Okay.
Woodley, hello. Thank you. How are you?
Should we, like, make sure people know that this was pre-planned, like we had booked me
yes.
on. This is not yep. a knee-jerk reaction.
Not
to,
an emergency request.
The news of the day.
He's yeah, not. You're not.
But it worked out.
You're not e-bugging onto our program today. Woody,
Actually, that's a good question, though. Who is going to be the E-Bug now? Because the other team's Abbotsford's gone, and they need two goalies for a three-game series on the road.
Well, and the Canucks will have
I got to go get my gear.
The Canucks will have to terminate the emergency conditions on the Seelovs loan as well, using one of their three pre-American League elimination call-ups. Woody, when Demko didn't take the ice for morning skate today, given how consistent he is with his routine, you had to know something was up, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, like, you know, that question is sort of, are they maybe trying to play some games and get in heads? Like, no, like, he is a creature of habit. The routine he does with Ian Clark is like clockwork. It's changed a little bit over the years, but that is how he gets ready to play a game. So as soon as he wasn't out there today, especially given the, you know, treatment not available post game on Sunday, we didn't see him, although I did confirm he was actually on the ice yesterday to give it a go. We didn't see him at the optional practice by the time we were allowed in the building. Yeah, him not being there this morning was clearly, you know, you knew something was up. There was no way that was part of, you know, any calculated anything.
What's the challenge for a goaltender like Demko, who we've seen, or sorry, like DeSmith, who we've seen play 29 games for the Canucks this season? We've seen him get 27 results. It's mostly been solid, and yet, you know, you did begin to see the seams just a little bit down the stretch once he's sort of overutilized as an everyday starter. What's the challenge for a goaltender in sort of that class at the NHL level when they're thrown into a playoff series against the same opponent a minimum of three times consecutively, unless Demko can get back for game four?
Yeah, no, not expecting that, Thomas. Mm-hmm. Not expecting that at all in this series. And frankly beyond. So it's the challenge is mostly mental. You've done the work, and we talked a lot about all the work that Casey did. You know, when Artur's got a run of starts ahead of him and how hard he worked out there. But actually, you had a good chat with him about that after the Edmonton game, and the real work was between the ears. You know, he talked to former playing partners. He talked to his wife. He talked to former coaches. He talked to a lot of different people about what he was going through. His agent, he mentioned, you know, because there were some struggles there. And sort of leading into that Edmonton game, like, that's the good news. He went through that struggle, came out the other side, and looked like the guy we'd seen for most of this season in that game in Edmonton. And as long as you provide him a similar defensive environment, that's what he's perfectly capable of doing. Are you getting the backdoor save on Anthony Beauvillier? Probably not. The list of guys that get there on that one is really short. I think the challenge as part of that, you know, sort of mentally for Casey DeSmith, is not to try to do too much. And we talked about that as well. Like, you can't do it in goaltending, right? You can't do it in golf. Can't walk up to the first tee and swing harder. And then temptation is to try, hey, it's the playoffs. I know guys who got years into their playoff careers before they started working with a mental skills coach and actually told me, they're like, you know, I played 5 years in the playoffs before realizing as a goalie, I actually don't need to try to do more in the postseason. So saying it and doing it are two different things. If he's over aggressive tonight, if he gets caught sort of swimming and chasing play a little bit, you know that, you know, that's not a good sign. When Casey's at his best, he lets it come to him. And the fact he sort of got over that hurdle mentally down the stretch and into that Edmonton game, to me, it's at least he has something he can go back to very recently to help him get ready for this one tonight.
On Demko himself, you know, we've heard the reporting that it's the same knee as was injured late in the regular season, but a different issue, not a re-injury or a setback of the issue that kept him out. Assuming that is the case, and, you know, credible reporting out there that that is the case, how do we interpret that, right? Because I think a setback maybe sounds worse, but it's still the same knee. So what do you make of the idea that, okay, not the same issue, but just in the same knee as the original issue was?
Well, I think that when you train to recover from an issue or an injury on one side of the knee, there's always going to be susceptibility on the other, whether it's front to back or side to side, anterior, posterior. You know, like, that's just, and you know, Demko was very open about how quickly he got back and how hard he worked to get back from this injury, right? And so if that was ahead of schedule, like, this, you know, I do believe the reporting and you know, that it's correct in terms of it not being the exact same injury, but being the same knee. But saying they're not related, are that's two different things, if that makes sense, right? Like both things can be true here. And so that's just part of it, right? Like, it doesn't mean, was it a mistake to come back that quick? It's the playoffs, right? Like, he would have been on board with wanting to get back for the playoffs. And he looks so good. I mean, you see the Bevilier save, and it wasn't that, right? Like, that wasn't where it happened. You see him make that save, and, you know, you sort of have this feeling, like, if he can make that save, he can do anything. And then, you know, as also reported sort of later in the third period, there was I actually think it may have been contact in the crease that led to it. I mean, at the end of the day, this is a position, and you put yourself in positions playing it that are just not natural for the human body. It puts a lot of stress on there. And so if you've got a joint that you've been working so hard on to get back, and there's still susceptibility in other areas of it, I guess the risk just goes up ever so much. And here we are today.
I
just mostly feel bad for him, because I know, you know, like, you know, we heard this from his teammates, and you know, like, we don't cheer for teams. I cheer for stories and good people. And, you know, I know how much this meant to Thatcher. I know how driven he is and how much he put into getting back. And you just, like, as a goalie guy, I love watching him play, right? Mm-hmm. Like the saves, like the one on Bevilier that only a handful of guys in the league can make. Like, that's what I want to see. But as Tockett said, you know, the playoffs are all about stories being written. And now it's Casey's chance to author one of his own.
You know, I won't ask you to speculate on timeline or anything. Obviously, the Canucks haven't said much. They might not know much themselves, and they'll be pretty reluctant to share any more information. But just, I find that really interesting, the idea of, okay, even if it's not the same injury, if you're working out and you're rehabbing from that one, that could create something that something different that happens. What, in general, again, not speculating on the specific timeline with Demko, but does that have any implications for, you know, the rehab process? Does it make it more difficult when it is kind of in that same area as your previous injury? Is there anything we can kind of draw about what to expect from Demko going forward based on potentially what you described there?
To be honest with you, like, I'm not a doctor, and I'm not going to play one on the radio. I just honestly don't know, right? Like, I do think this is probably, you know, I think you're probably looking at similar timelines would be my guess, but whether that's because of the nature of the previous injury or not, I can't say. And listen, you know, we heard he was on the ice yesterday and confirmed that. If anyone will be determined and find a way to get back faster than should be humanly possible, it's going to be Thatcher Demko. And again, unfortunately, that's part of what we're dealing with right now.
Kevin, switching gears to what we saw in Game 1, Canucks really seemed to be hunting UC Saros' blocker, especially after the Elias Lindholm goal, although I think they were shooting that way beforehand as well. What did you notice about how Vancouver tried to attack Saros that seemed well-prepared, that sort of you took as, like, signal for something that fans should watch for tonight as well?
Well, there's the Lindholm one, but then also Pettersson from the right dot on a power play with an open look. And for him to sort of shoot it off that right hip rather than high blocker or by the ear on the glove side tells me there's a pre-scout. And when I look at the numbers, it makes sense. In the regular season, 11 goals between the blocker arm and the body for UC Saros. I don't know if that's a league high, but it's got to be close. There aren't a lot of guys. Like, that's not a spot you normally see numbers like that on. Save percentage in that area in the regular season, 656. So when you see that in the numbers leading into a series and you see good shooters appear to target that, you know that's probably part of a pre-scout, and that's something they're going to continue to go after. And, you know, what can happen in a series like this when if that becomes something they continue to go after, like, you know, it's like a goalie getting beat 5-0 and then feeling like they got to get to the ice quicker after it happens and then giving up more upstairs, right? So if they continue to go after it and they have success, and that Pettersson one almost got through as well, then for a goalie who's already small, the temptation or the reaction can be, I'm not going to say that UC's going to do this, but is to sort of start pulling an in-tighter a little earlier, maybe losing a little bit of that reactivity on the blocker side on shots that are towards the perimeter of the net. That's what you do when you set out a pre-scout legacy. You try and create that seed of doubt in the goalie's head. And, you know, for a goalie that already has, like, he's got an incredible glove. Numbers are way better on the glove side than the blocker, so that's already going to be an area you target. I think the other thing you saw is the layered screens, and it's something they've done well all year. But it's not just because it's a good way to score, and they've got a guy in Hughes who can find those spots and take advantage of it. But you saw specifically on the Suter goal that retreat behind that traffic, where just as the shot's released, there's a drift back. As opposed to holding edges and making himself bigger, can get a little smaller by retreating back behind that traffic. And that's something I expect, A, because this is how they've scored all year, but B, because of that tendency that you'll see the Canucks continue to try and take advantage of.
With DeSmith in particular, do you expect that to change anything from a really savvy offensive team in the Predators in terms of what they're going to look to do in attacking Vancouver?
Well, you know, it's pre-scout changes, right? Like the, you know, and when I talk about the details that we just mentioned with UC, like, man, like the work that goes into this, you know, I've been privy to it in years past with some of the legends of the game, like Mitch Korn, former Nashville goalie coach. Like, they're going through every single goal that a goalie gives up over the year, and they are charting every tendency, every trend, and they're trying to see if there are any things that tie in number-wise to what they see with their eyes, and then they're looking. I think my favorite example was a John Gibson against Edmonton playoff series where the Oilers literally scored the tying and winning goal on puck shot from behind the goal line, off banked off of his skate being outside his goal post to push across, that you would never take without a pre-scout. And it literally got them a game in the series and also forced Gibson to change how he played on his post. So I'm sure they're going to try and find details within DeSmith's game, and post play will be one of them, right? Like, you saw them try sharp angle shots on Thatcher Demko a couple of times in that game. Forsberg had one, and Thatcher's got that short side post sealed up so well in the reverse. His head's right up there, like, shoulder and head right against the post. Casey DeSmith can't do that. Like, he can't get that coverage and be inside the post. For him to get that type of vertical coverage, he has to have a skate outside the post. So there's a give and take there. For Casey to get the vertical coverage on his net play, he has to be outside the post, which means any push across, if you wrap or seam it through the middle down low, is a much bigger rotation and recovery for him than it is for Thatcher Demko, who's inside the post and up to the top of it and just shifts off and gets to the other side, right? So strengths and weaknesses are different, and I think you'll see the Predators, like, you know, I would assume you're going to see them start to go after those on KC in different ways from how they tried to attack Thatcher Demko. Although, to be honest with you, I was kind of surprised to see the dead angle shot in the first place, because in 2 years, I
Yeah, we might have just lost. Oh, we got Kevin Woodley back there. You froze on our screen.
Sorry,
for a
and
second.
You froze that in 2 years. You
haven't seen him give up a goal like that on the dead angle, short side high. Like, it just doesn't happen because he's so good at it. So I'll be curious to see. I was surprised to see them try that, but I won't be at all surprised to see them try more of it with Casey DeSmith tonight.
And I'm curious, Kevin. You know, we're talking about the opposition pre-scouting the opposition goalie, right? But if Nashville knows, hey, we might try some of those bad angle shots on Casey DeSmith because of some of the ways, you know, he plays on the post, is that something the Canucks are aware of and communicating to their players as well? Like, hey, this is probably what the pre-scout says. And I know Tocchet can say, like, we're not going to play any differently in front of Casey DeSmith at a general level. But do they take that into consideration when they're defending in zone now with Casey DeSmith in net?
No, I don't think, like, because you can't go outside of what you've done all season defensively, right? Like, you have to trust that your goaltender, even though he does it differently than Thatcher, you have to trust that the way he's, the method he's found that solves that short side high problem, he's got it covered, and don't change what you're doing. What I think we've seen them do very well all season in front of Casey is take care of the front of the net. Especially after the early part of the year where we saw a lot of rebounds. And again, Not all rebounds are bad rebounds. He does a really good job of keeping them in front of him rather than spilling out the ones to the side. But there does tend to be a lot more second chance opportunities when Casey's in net compared to Thatcher. And I think Vancouver's done an exceptional job in front of him of making sure they take care of those chances. And that, again, will be a big part of the challenge tonight, you know, against a Predators team that's probably going to be more desperate to get to those areas than you would see, you know, when it's like, you know, Nashville on a Tuesday, 82. And especially after their head coach, Andrew Burnett, sort of challenged them and called them out for not getting inside enough in game one.
With just in your view, right? How much does Demko's absence alter things for the Canucks, like alter this matchup? And I don't mean in terms of like the probability they win, but just in terms of the gravity, the confidence, the size, like the deterrent that Demko sort of brings to the net. How different is this series without him?
Well, I mean, it's the confidence you have. Like, if you make a mistake, if you turn the puck over at the blue line and you give up a 2-on-1 and nobody covers Anthony Beauvillier, right? Like, yeah. I'm not saying – and listen, like Casey's incredibly fast, right? Like, mm-hmm. He's really quick along the ice. But the push, the power, and then the full extension into the splits, right? Like, it's a pretty short list of guys that get there the way Thatcher Demko got there in that one, right? So, you know, I mean, I think the confidence is the biggest one out of all the things you said. Like, can they maintain that confidence? Can Casey instill it in the group with a strong early, performance early so that they can all sort of feel it and start to build off it? Like, he's only got one playoff start, and I know it ended in double overtime when he had to come out and ended up having core surgery, but he stopped, 48 of 51 before he left that game. So can you instill some of the confidence if, you know, whether it's wavering or not, like, just make sure you build it back up, especially early. I think early in this game is going to be really important. I do believe they've played enough in front of them that they won't feel like they have to do too much, because that is a slippery slope. If you go out there defensively as a group and feel like, oh, I got to block this shot in a lane where I'm not normally at because it's not Thatcher Demko, then you're in trouble. Because now everybody's trying to do everybody else's job and nobody's doing your own. And I've seen that go downhill for goalies and teams really quick. But I think it won't happen with Casey DeSmith and them.
Just before we let you go, Kevin, obviously we saw Artur Shelov get some games for the Canucks, get some wins as well in the regular season when Demko was out. What would have to happen? You know, how long is the leash going to be for Casey DeSmith, do you think, in this series before Shelov's would be an option?
That's a good question. I think the game in Edmonton means it's going to be longer than it would have been without the game in Edmonton. Let's put it that way. I think if the Preds start to open up and create a lot of time and space for their top players off the rush, and, you know, start to get open looks that exploit maybe Casey's size. Although I really love early in this season, especially how patient he was on his edges on a lot of those high shots. I think back to that first Edmonton game, and not that it's the only time it happened, but it's the one that jumps out where, like, guys like McDavid from point blank, and he's holding edges and making high blocker saves and, you know, really reacting and not defaulting down prematurely. Like, he's capable of all that against elite players. But if they're able to create space and he is a little more passive and he does get exploited, do you go for the size and sort of, you know, again, pointing back to that Beauvillier save, like, there's more of that in Shelov's higher ceiling, I guess I would say, potentially. But the floor is higher and steadier by far right now. I think that's fair to say. I shouldn't say by far, but I think fair to say for Casey DeSmith.
Woodley, really appreciate it. Great stuff, man. As you said, we had you booked anyways, and not that I wanted this news to happen, but I was glad we had you on the show to help us understand it better. Thanks for doing this. We'll talk again soon.
I'm just happy the Wi-Fi at Rogers Arena actually made it through.
It made it through. A couple of dicey moments, but it worked.
You like the backdrop, like we're up at the podium right now.
Yeah.
I'm feeling. But the alternative was to do it from where I'm actually working, which is around the corner in a bathroom.
I was hoping we didn't get any flush sound effects while you were you're on air with us.
By the way, I don't usually get the opportunity to do this, but right now, because Rogers Arena is stuffed to the brim with media, they've rearranged my seatmates. So I'm currently sitting, and it's Harmon with me at center and Woodley coming out from the crease to play on my right wing. And I'm telling you right now, it's like one of the best game viewing experiences from like a data drop perspective that I could have. I have Harmon pointing out like vagaries of like forechecking structure, and then Woodley noticing every type of shot and what teams are trying to get. It's great. I've never had a clearer view of games. Everyone should have this experience.
We'll see you in 5 hours for more.
Looking forward to it, bud.
Thank you, Woodley. That is Kevin Woodley on Sportsnet 650, brought to you by White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George and White Rock or whiterockhyundai.com.
We need like an alt feed, Woodley and Dial. I'm telling you, man, it is unbelievable the amount of information I'm getting in real time.
I mean, Woodley, no disrespect to Harmon. I like Harmon a lot. Obviously, he has great insight. But just Woodley with the goalie expertise is just, it's he's not, very good at what he does.
I want the Drancer alt stream is what I want.
I'm not kidding. Kevin Woodley is, in my opinion, the best like hockey watcher on the planet.
Wow. The best hockey watcher on the planet.
He notices so much stuff. He's goated.
That is incredibly high praise.
There's no one else who I like need their take on stuff as much as like even when we're not sitting together, I'll sometimes like walk across the press box and be like, what happened? What did you see there?
Mm.
You know? Because he'll yeah, he's awesome.
Dimitri is very offended.
Dimitri is also a very good hockey watcher.
All right. You can do tiers.
One day. I don't know. I don't get to watch the games with everybody.
Hockey watcher tiers.
my friend Kieran.
Number one, you, the fan.
Yeah.
Crushing it.
Man on the street.
Yeah. Hey, you're number one in my heart, for sure.
I just want to give a shout out, by the way. A lot of fans blaming DJ here for his song, which has Demko in the chorus, for this injury. Mm-hmm. Unfair. Unfair. You can like the song or not, but that has nothing to do with it. Free DJ here.
Taking a stand against the concept of curses.
100%.
Curses against magic in the world.
I am absolutely against magic and all magical thinking, as always. Hashtag free DJ here.
All right, that's it for the show. Keep it right here, of course. Game 2 tonight at 7 from Rogers Arena. Canucks, Predators, no Demko, but the Canucks looking to take a 2-0 series lead. We'll be back tomorrow here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.